You don't want to do anything? You want to put it on pause? No, it's not. Okay. Great. I, that's fine. But can we hear what you have to say?
Yeah. Oh, I don't want to have it on the record. No.
Yeah, then that's no problem. Exactly. Okay, great.
Carol, can I get you on the other side of the Commonwealth Club song? This is for Faye, so that Faye knows that he was really here.
Alan and his camera.
Alan, okay. Everything must be documented.
All right. All right.
I got a nice card.
Oh, okay. Oh, really?
All right, so David is going to give his talk, and everybody knows what the topic is. David is a doctor, and we have a very interesting family connection, which was very, very ironic in such a small group. David's grandfather or father?
Father.
Father's from Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm from Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Oh,
I have a brother who lives out in New Hampshire, where David also lives. During most of the year, and he ran into my brother because of the Kenosha connection of the class 25 years ago, and then he gives lectures out here, and a couple of years ago, at a very well attended and very good lecture, I came and watched the lecture, something that you had set up, and I introduced somebody a couple of days later at a different. In any case, David realized that I was probably the brother of his friend out in Wisconsin because we out in New Hampshire. We look enough alike. And it's absolutely true.
Like a ghost.
Like a ghost of each other, exactly. No, families have the same
genes.
Same genes, yes, exactly. So, David will give an informal version of his talk. It's a nice small group of us.
Well, we have three physicians or physicians to be. So, one, two, three, four physicians to be. Physicians.
Yeah. Right.
And one expert on public speaking.
PhD.
A doctor of public speaking.
No, communication disorders.
I fit right in, don't I?
Yeah.
here's someone who wants to talk to you. Okay.
Actually, I have central auditory processing disorder, so it's right up her alley. So if I'm tracking you very closely, it's...
Okay, so we're going to make this very informal because we all want to believe. Tell you how this topic came about, but first I should, for those who don't know, a little bit about me, so you know what the deal is. I practiced ophthalmology for 25 years, eye surgery, but that was after having been very fortunate to spend 4 years at Harvard College, exposed to a number of different things, one of which was constitutional law, which I really loved. So I did a lot of constitutional law as an undergraduate. And then when I realized that you can't just do it and go to the Supreme Court, I investigated what lawyers do. And I didn't like what 99% of them do. And so I said, hell with that, I'm going to go to medical school. And so I put that all aside. And when I decided I'd had enough of medicine, I went back to Harvard for a second time and earned a degree in history of science. And that, I did courses for retirees for a lot of years. But in 2003, people were really upset with Patriot Act. So I went back to Harvard for a third time in constitutional law and spent the whole semester deeply embedded night and day in constitutional law. And with the idea of trying to figure out how to explain this stuff, which I find very intriguing to a lay audience. It's got to be made simple to a lay audience. And I've been doing that on and off since 2003. And one of the opportunities that has come to me is to be able to go to the College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, every September, where they have a Supreme Court preview symposium, where at the law school in lovely Williamsburg, they invite 20 constitutional law professors, 20 Supreme Court litigators, and 20 Supreme Court journalists. David Savage from L.A., Linda Greenhouse from New York Times, Vlad Venison from Baltimore Sun, etc. So there are 60 people there who that's all their life is the Supreme and they spend the weekend examining and discussing and presenting the cases that would be upcoming that the court has agreed to hear, and predicting what the problems are, what the nuances are, and et cetera. So the whole weekend is spent analyzing the cases that will be heard over the next 9 months. Okay, I was there a few years ago and heard about the new lots of cases. I'm the fly on the wall. I get to go. And I was listening to them, and I heard about this one particular case that I'm going to share with you this afternoon, and it just, I thought this was really cool. This is a really good case. And they discussed it. I heard the professors there, and I thought it was just perfect for what I do. And so it's this case that I'm going to present to you, but in the format of a discussion. And the idea is for the groups to whom I do this to learn the tests, the questions, which the court asks themselves in order to decide a very thorny problem. And these answers are not so easy. But they are not arrived at ad hoc. There's a huge amount of analysis and thought that goes into it. And this is one of the really fun cases. I thought it was good, and I've had fun with it. So I'm going to share that with you. And so what this whole thing is a discussion which doesn't hit the court very often of, under the category of free speech, deciding whether something is government speech or private speech. And all the stuff I've done up to this case, I had never thought about this particular problem. And so let's go back for just a second and talk about why our Constitution and our country protects free speech. Why do we think it's a good idea? After all, you know, these things weren't handed down on Sinai. They evolved. And there have to be reasons why. And we know that all speech isn't protected. You know, all the wonderful homes having things that say you can't yell fire in a crowded theater when there's no fire. If there's a fire, you might be able to yell fire and protect people's lives. So truth sometimes is a defense. But some speech, pornography, obscenity, libel, slander, and there's other categories of speech that are not protected. And so so what are the reasons? I'm going to go through this very quickly. What are the reasons underlying why we have free speech? And the first is that you can't have a democratic society where the people decide who they want to be in their government by the people, for the people, if people can't speak freely. So certainly in a communist country or a dictatorship, you don't need free speech, just do what the dictator does. In a democracy, you have to protect free speech. Okay. The second is that in our society, we go to school, we constantly try to search for what the truth is. There's a reason why the oldest university in the country, Harvard, established in 1636, has as their crest Veritas. They look for truth in every subject. And so you can't look for truth if you can't share ideas, and ideas are shared by talking. So that's generally the second reason. The third reason, as a safety valve. Now this can be seen so clearly in South Africa during the era of apartheid, when free speech was not allowed. And Nelson Mandela, who wanted to try to end apartheid and give everybody a vote, tried to speak. The ANC, of which he became the leader, tried to speak, and they were suppressed. Mandela was certainly no radical, he was no terrorist, he was not violent, but he was suppressed. And as a last resort, if you read his book, The Long March to Freedom, he makes it very clear that there was no safety valve in South Africa. People were not allowed to speak, such as people marching around the White House or carrying placards on Market Street. We have safety valves. Get out there and express yourself. But in South Africa, they weren't allowed to. And so they're erupts into violence. So the third good reason for free speech is as a safety valve, so you don't end up in violence. It's like a pot that's boiling and you put a cover on it. It's going to explode without a safety valve. And the fourth reason is that we value the self. We value individuals. And if you have something to say, whether it's against the government, or for any other reason, you want to paint something and hang it in the Brooklyn Museum, whether it's a flowers or a pornography, that's your choice. You're expressing yourself. And so we protect that as a value. So generally speaking, as a background, these are the four philosophical reasons why we value free speech. Now, what is a public forum? And I'm going to go quickly through this. A public forum is usually considered the geographic area in which free speech is not only tolerated, but encouraged. And the prime example would be Hyde Park Corner in London, where you get up on a box in Hyde Park Corner and say anything you like. And the fact is, so is Market Street, and so is Powell Street, and Sutter Street. And in fact, all the streets in San Francisco and the streets of America are what we consider public forums. You can go outside and say what you want. You can say almost anything you want. The one exception would be, for instance, Lafayette Square, opposite the White House, where you can say almost anything, and you can say, I don't like President Bush or President Obama. And you can have 10,000 people listening to you. You can all agree we don't like President Obama, and that's protected. And that's a public forum. On the other hand, if you raise a knife or a revolver and you say, let's go, that's imminent. That's an imminent. It's not only clear and present, it's imminent. So, but the idea is that public forums are protected. So Golden Gate Park would be considered a public forum. You can go walk in the middle of, and it's valued for that reason. You can say what you want in Golden Gate Park. So last night I went to a movie at the Embarcadero. Well, the Embarcadero is private property, I guess. And I'm walking down, and the question is, well, if somebody wants to give a talk or speech on any subject, whether you like it or not, in the middle of the Embarcadero, or how about Stone Street Mall or some big mall around here, and you're in a mall, well, there are a lot of, that becomes a little questionable. It's a private area, but the public is using it, right? So for reasons of public forum analysis, it becomes more shady. How about an airport? It's a public area, and it's owned by the city. It's owned by the government. Is that a public forum? Can you say what you want in an airport? Well, actually, yes, you can. And can you hand out literature? Yes, you can. Can you ask for money? No, you can't, because that's going to interfere with passengers walking to their airport. So the tolerance is very high for protecting public forum. So you get the idea roughly of what I mean by a public, what is meant, not me, but what is meant by a public forum. Okay? All right. And so streets and parks are what is referred to as public forums. Now, here's the question. Do public forums, for legal purposes, necessarily include and accommodate permanent monuments as they do speech, pamphlets, and gatherings? So go to any of the parks here in San Francisco, and you will see monuments, whether it's out by the ocean or in Golden Gate Park or anywhere else. And look at the monument. And you say, well, whose monument is that? Well, maybe somebody donated the monument. In most cases, they're donated monuments. And so a question comes up as to who's speaking. And we'll see what happens. So here's the story very quickly. Up in a town called Pleasant Grove, Oregon, there was a park in this small town. And 40 years ago, they had decided that the park should accommodate various exhibitions of memorabilia to history, monuments that had something to do with history. And so 40 years ago, the Knights of Columbus donated a monument of the Ten Commandments. And the city said, yeah, that's a historical monument. That goes way back. And nobody's forced to look at it. Nobody's forced to read it. Nobody's forced to do anything. But that is what we consider a historical monument. Not too much thought was given to it. And so in the park at Pleasant Grove, Oregon, sat this Ten Commandments. And there it is. And it's been there for 40 years. Nobody paid attention. No big deal. Okay. Then along came a group called Summa. And this is a small religious sect of not more than a few hundred, a few thousand people up in Oregon who have they believe in what they call the seven aphorisms. And these aphorisms are strange to most of us. Most of us sort of get a little uneasy with these. Psychokinesis, correspondence, vibration, and they believe in mummification. And it pushes the envelope a little bit in terms of what most of us believe. But so does any religion in which we don't believe. Judaism stretches the envelope for Catholics, and Catholics stretch it for Lutherans. So this is what they believe. They have a right to what they believe. Okay, so what happened in this little town in Oregon is the good people of Summon decided that, they'd like to, at their expense, have a monument created and donate this monument to the city for erection in the park. They pay for it, and there would be, and on the monument would be these seven aphorisms. And so they donated the monument to the city, and the city went cuckoo. They didn't know what to do with this monument. And so they politely refused. They said, we're just not going to put it up. No big deal, we're just not going to put it up. And so this group found a very, very smart lawyer who happened to live in Atlanta, I know him, and unfortunately, he's very bright. I don't like it, but he's very bright. And he brought this case, which worked its way up over the years to the Supreme Court. And it was certainly a First Amendment case because it had to do with speech in a public forum. And it had to do with religion. So it was right in the First Amendment, right? Right to practice religion, the right to be free of government's interference with religion, government shouldn't be involved in religion, but also free speech. And so the question came up, what kind of speech, what kind of case is this? Is this a speech case? Is it free speech? Or is it a religion case? And is it a religion case or a speech case? And the difference is critical. And so now, what I want to do is you now understand the problem. How are the justices going to decide this case? You've got the essential facts. It's very simple. They want to put this monument. They donate it. There it is. And the city doesn't want to do it. But they've already, 40 years ago, accepted this Ten Commandments. And it's been sitting there. Nobody's objected for 40 years. Not one whisper.
Some of them not objecting to the Ten Commandments. They just want to add their own.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're not saying you have to take out the Ten Commandments. They just donated this, and please put this in your park also. Okay. And so what I want to do is go through with you and analyze the questions that are involved. Okay. So let's first assume it's a free speech case. Okay? Now, if it's a free speech case, we have to ask, is it private speech or government speech? Now, that is a very interesting question, which I had never considered until I became aware of this case and the analysis. And I imagine you don't either. If you drive down the street, it doesn't occur to you, is the government speaking or is a private person speaking? When you see a license plate that says peace, someone has chosen their own license plate, the state produced that license plate. And you paid the state $20 or $30 for that license plate, but it's your message on state property. And you see it, is the state speaking or are you speaking? And we'll see how that plays out. That happens all the time. Well, if you go to Sacramento and say, well, I want a license plate that says some derogatory word, some F word or something, they won't print it. They'll have a list of words they won't print. Well, so who's the censor? Some person with a high school or dropped out of high school who's sitting in Sacramento who's deciding what they like and don't like? Is that free speech? Right? That's who's the censor? But they are censoring. Okay. They're censoring. And you'll say, well, for goodness sakes, we're glad. I don't want to see all this stuff. My license plate's all over. So you see there's a line. And unresolved is still the question, license plate, state speech, private speech.
Yeah. South Carolina has
now let's follow this. He's always giving me one hand. Okay, so let's look at why this matters. And remember, now we're going to decide private speech, government speech. That's the question. Okay, so now let's look at the analysis of private speech. That's you and me talking. Okay? And what we're going to be looking at
is to what degree and how can the government control private speech with a statute? What laws can the government pass to restrict private speech? And so there are three possible statutes. And let's go through and understand these. The first kind of statute is what is called generally a neutral rule of general applicability. And these occur all the time, you're just not aware of it. And I'll make up a silly one to give you an example. Okay, the city of San Francisco may have a statute that says no sound trucks on the streets of San Francisco after 10:30 at night. Okay? That is interfering with speech, isn't it? That's a definite government interference with speech. But it's what is called a neutral rule of general applicability. It's not saying no sound trucks announcing a Republican candidate after 10:30 at night, or no sound trucks espousing a liberal cause after 10:30 at night. Right? It is neutral, and it applies to everyone. It's not signaling out any group or person, and it's not favoring one view or another. If a statute were passed in San Francisco, no parades down Market Street between 4 and 6 o'clock p.m. on weekdays. There's good reason for that. There's a lot of traffic. We got to get there. It's interfering with free speech. I want to talk on Market Street. Well, you can talk on Market Street, but walk on the sidewalk, say what you want, but don't interfere with some other thing. So that would be a neutral rule of general applicability. And there are thousands of them that you could dream up. Okay. So that's a neutral rule. It's called an NRGA. And there are thousands of them. Okay. The second kind of statute is what they call a statute which restricts certain subjects. So, for instance, no talk on Main Street about politics. No talk on the campus of San Francisco State about ethnic issues. No speeches at San Francisco State or Berkeley about religion. Why? Why would they want to do that? Well, to keep peace and quiet and order. Because if someone gives a speech about something, whether pro or con, about ethnic issues or religion or race or gender or gay or whatever you want to talk about, it's going to cause some feelings, right? And there might be a feeling that a statute should be passed which restricts certain subjects. Okay? So a statute which restricts subject matter is a subject-based restriction. Okay? That's the second type of statute, which interferes in speech. And the third type of statute is one which restricts a viewpoint. So an example of a viewpoint restriction in San Francisco might be no speeches are allowed from Van Ness Avenue between Van Ness and the Ferry Building, which is in favor of the Democrats. And no speeches from Van Ness out to the ocean favoring the gay community. You can have speeches west of Van Ness against the gay community, but not for the gay community. That would be a viewpoint-based restriction. You understand the difference? That's a viewpoint-based restriction. So we have a neutral rule of general applicability, no sound trucks after 10:30 at night, a subject-based, and a viewpoint-based. Those differences are critical. Okay. So now what tests does the government use to decide whether a statute fits these categories and what does they do? Well, let's take them one by one to see. If a statute falls into the category of restricting speech and it's a neutral rule of general applicability, what test is used? The test that the Supreme Court asks as to whether this statute is constitutional or not is to whether the legislature had a rational basis for a legitimate state interest.
statute, like a no people with short haircuts after 10:30 at night. That's not a subject-based, and it's not a viewpoint-based. It's a neutral rule. But there's no rational basis for it. There's got to be a rational basis for a legitimate state interest. And so that's the test, which gives the legislature big leeway to pass rational basis tests. Any questions? If there's a question, stop me. You need to understand. Okay. So if the legislature has a rational basis for passing the statute, it's fine. If a statute restricts a subject, now we're getting dicey. The court requires the statute to satisfy two requirements. Otherwise, it's unconstitutional. The first, those two tests are called strict scrutiny. That will elicit the court to require a look at strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny means that the legislature must have a compelling state interest. A compelling state interest might be at a state school, that the purpose for people to be at Berkeley or San Francisco State is for education, not to cause riots. And that might be a compelling state. I'm not saying it is, but that might be a compelling state interest. And the statute has to affect as few people as possible. Okay. And secondly, and so that's the test if it's subject-based. And if it's a viewpoint-based restriction, it's unconstitutional. There are no legitimate constitutional viewpoint-based restrictions. The government may not say a limit of viewpoint. Okay? And so it would have been unconstitutional to say that you cannot get up in front of City Hall and object to the Vietnam draft or against Iraq. And it got very dicey when they tore their draft cards. It couldn't be decided here because that was a viewpoint. They were expressing a viewpoint in symbolic speech. So the court twisted it around and said you were destroying government property. Okay, but you understand these three tests. Okay, so in review, these are the three kind of statutes, and this is how they're judged. Okay, so now we have a private speech, and the other possible, that's the analysis of private speech. What about government speech? Okay, summa monument is certainly a viewpoint of the donor. We would agree, right? Believe in summa. It's their viewpoint. And if it is that, and it's a speech case, the government may not limit any viewpoint. And that's what they're doing. They're cutting off someone's viewpoint. Okay, that's if they decide on that issue. Okay, if it's private speech, there we are. But now, how do we look at government speech? Interestingly enough, the government that we've elected may choose to say anything it wishes. That's very interesting. We never thought about that. But we've elected the people to be our government, and we can elect new government if we don't like what they're saying. And so our president gets up there and says, I want a health policy. And he goes around the country using government money to do that. Or we drive down Market Street and it says 30 miles an hour. Or drive carefully. The government is not obligated to say drive recklessly. Or the government is very free to put up a big billboard and buy government bonds. They are not forced to put up an equal sign that says don't buy government bonds. We voted for that government. And if we don't like what they are saying, we elect a new government. That's how that works. And drive carefully, they're not obligated to say drive recklessly. I never thought about that before, but that is the way it is. That's government speech. So the government can say anything it likes, and it may choose a viewpoint. Support our soldiers, support the Iraq War, support Barack Obama. The government, that's our government, with one exception. Government speech, any subject is okay with this viewpoint, except religion. The government may
They are prohibited. So if it's private speech, a viewpoint is protected. If it's government speech, it's also assumed to be okay, except if it has anything to do with religion. Right? In other words, you cannot have a Barack Obama come out or a government manifesto come out or a document come out and say, everybody should bow down to Lutheranism. That would be find that crazy, because we're not used to that. The reason, there's a very good reason we're not used to it. Government's prohibited from a viewpoint on religion. But they're not prohibited from a viewpoint on anything else. If you don't like it, elect a new government. Okay. So now how does this play out? Well, you see here, if we go back now with the Sumum case, private speech, no viewpoint regulation. Government, religion is prohibited. And we have a monument that is a religious declaration. And it's being given by a private person to the government. Very interesting point, situation. And so we're trying to decide who is speaking. And that's what the court had to decide. If the city accepts this monument, who is speaking? Because that is the determining factor. If it's a private person speaking, the monument goes in. If it's the government speaking, cannot do. They have a right to refuse. They put it in if they want, unless it's religious. And it is religious, and they can't do it. Okay, that's. And so the question is trying to decide who is the literal speaker, who controls the message. These are the questions the court asks. Who is the literal speaker? Who controls the message? Who pays for the message? What is the program speech's goal? And this is the key. To whom would a reasonable person attribute the speech? You go through the park, and that's the kind of questions the court asks. Who would I assume is speaking? You know, when you go through the Boston Common and you see this big monument of the black soldiers fighting in the Revolutionary War, you know, who is speaking in that monument? Is it the NAACP speaking? Or is it our government speaking? Or is it the private group speaking that they put it up? These are all questions that can be raised. And so here we have a question of this First Amendment, whether it should be considered a free speech case or whether it should be an establishment clause religion case. And if so, you see if it's establishment, is it private speech? If it's private speech, then it's protected. If it's government speech, it is not. If it's free speech here and government speech, then it is protected either way. Okay, and so the question is how did these nine people decide this? And there was great consternation, and there was supposed to be a big split, liberal, conservative, et cetera, because after all, your own Stephen Breyer, here from California, when they had two cases, the Tenth Commandment cases, same year, one from Kentucky, one Texas, Austin, Texas. The Kentucky case, they put the Ten Commandments on the steps up to the courthouse, up to the courtroom in the courthouse. In Texas, it's out of the park. And it was 5-4 in each case. However, Breyer switched votes. And Breyer from San Francisco voted no for the Kentucky one, but he voted yes. It's okay in Texas. And Scalia wrote that if you're walking through the park in Texas, nobody's pushing anybody. Usually, his words, divert your eyes. Nobody's pushing anything on you. There's no feeling of coercion. On the other hand, when you're going up for a trial and you're walking right past this thing glaring you in the face by the government, that's a very different situation. And it was on that basis that Breyer switched votes. And because of his switch, it was not allowed in Kentucky, and it was allowed in Texas. And so when this case came up, they said, wow, what is Breyer going to do? And how is he going to see this? Because this sort of has elements of both. And this was a very carefully, it's not going to affect affect anybody in the country, but intellectually it's a really good case on these arguments. Okay, it's your, what do you think, what would you guess? I assume you don't know what happened here. What would you guess?
How?
This is a couple years ago, so we, everything's in, it's done. Carol?
No idea.
Alan?
I would say they let the monument go in.
Let the monument go in?
Yes.
And by how, what vote and how they split?
5-4.
5-4?
Yes.
With Kennedy saying he's the swing vote?
Yeah.
And let it go in?
Yeah.
And Breyer against it, and Kennedy did?
No, those five were before.
Well, these would be six, and the three liberals would say no. Is that how you can do it? Carol, what do you think? Okay. George?
Well, I think they thought I'd focus on a different issue, which is, you know, I could force the government to put it in. I mean, the government has to decide one way or the other whether you put it in. And I would guess that they would vote 9 in favor of not forcing the government to put it in.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe everybody voted in one way. The local government can make the decision. Certainly, if they made the decision the other way, I'd put it in park, then it would be like a park in Austin, Texas. Right? So it wouldn't be a problem. But if they decide against it, they can't be forced to take things that they don't want to. That might have gotten everybody.
Clairvoyant individuals. Very good. You're right. It was unanimous.
Wow.
Most scholars were stunned. And interestingly enough, in Williamsburg, I was with all of these scholars and writers and thinkers, and they were pulling their hair out of their faces. And they really made it sound really complicated and really, how did they get the side? And headaches at night figuring out how you're going to weave your way through this intellectually. And the court treated it like, that's how brilliant these guys are. Like, it's no big deal. I mean, what are you getting excited about? I was all excited watching this being argued and all, having been clued in Williamsburg, and it was unanimous. And here was their saying, permanent monuments in public parks are not subject to free speech analysis that applies to speeches and pamphlets in public parks. A donated monument becomes government speech. Once you give a monument, this was the key, once you give a monument, it's the government's. And the government is speaking.
The monument is formally defined.
It's permanent.
As a permanent structure.
A permanent. It's not a placard,
uh-huh.
You know, that comes down tomorrow. It's a permanent monument. It's going to stay there next week and next year and assume for
any of the definition of a monument.
Yeah, well, okay.
So if the religious group had stuck to the history that this was a unique aspect of life in this town, that this particular religion has been established there, they might have been able to put in information about
it. Well, yeah,
that
you see, now he's not a friend of mine, but the lawyer who I know, who argued it for Summa, chose to argue it on free speech grounds, not religion grounds. That's how he had to choose one way or the other. He had to guess which way the court's going to go. And he lost 100% against the court. And it was unanimous that a donated monument becomes government speech, and the government can choose what they want to say. Right? And they're saying, we're not deciding whether it should go in or not. It's up to the government. A donated monument is government. The court didn't decide it should go in. The court decided, made the decision. I mean, so good. A monument becomes, if you give a monument to the city of San Francisco, you're done. Once you give it, now they can do what they want with it. They can put it up in the attic.
So the Knights of Columbus one they could take away?
Well, they've been there for 40 years, and yes. If the government decides they want to take the Ten Commandments away, they can. They can. It's their speech. And if you don't like it, you can elect a new government in this town and put it back.
That allows the prevailing religious group of the area.
No, because the government cannot come out with a religious statement. And the Ten Commandments was looked at as it was accepted as a historical monument, as a historical thing, not a religious thing. Nobody objected to it. So there's a little leeway there. You're quite right. The government is not going to put up a Lutheran monument, and this is what's being fought in San Diego. If you know San Diego, there's a there's a huge crucifix.
she jumped out on the property. There's another case out in the Mojave Desert, and they put up a cross out there in the cemetery, and to honor the Lord dead, and it's a crucifix. At any rate, these are religious statements on government property, and there's a big problem. But here, the court said something different. Here, the court simply said, a monument is the government talking, and they're free to do what they want. But they're not free if it's a religious statement to do what they want, but they can't.
You know, in the city of San Francisco, they have a cross on Mount Davis, very, very prominent cross. This issue, of course, came up and was settled by selling it to the Armenian community for a dollar. That it be a statement against the genocide by the Turks.
Okay. Now, that kind of thing is happening in Mojave Desert, where it was on federal property, and the feds, facing this lawsuit, decided they're going to sell 9 square feet in the Mojave Desert to a private group. And that's subterfuge.
That's how we do it.
That's subterfuge. Right? Okay, but now let me take you to the last step in this, and then we're going to have. It wasn't just a unanimous. It was unanimous, but much more interesting than the unanimity were the reasons. The justices broke. They all had their say, and it would be very interesting for me now to show you how they all were unanimous, but they all got their shaking.
Different reasons.
Here are the liberals, the two far left liberals, Ginsburg and Stephen, are not excerpting their pages and pages of concurrence. It was a concurring opinion, but for different reasons. Essentially, they said that while the free speech clause neither restricts nor protects government speech, government speakers are bound by the Constitution Establishment Clause and the Equal Protection Clause. So essentially, that's religion. And so what they're saying is that the government may not transgress across that line with religion. And these two were given fair warning that the crosses and all that kind of stuff is going to have to go. But in this case, and that's what I was just saying. So they're taking the heart, and they're announcing, in their opinion, that if you just read the majority opinion, in which everyone concurs, that doesn't give governments license to extol a viewpoint on religion. And the question is, does it even give, and this is where Scalia breaks off, does it even give governments, or does it prevent governments from talking about religion per se? In other words, what if the government put up a big sign, have a religion, which is essentially what they're doing in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance under God. And if a school board, as it occurred in San Francisco, the Ninth Circuit went right to the Supreme Court and they turned it back on technicality, that is essentially saying that everybody should believe in God. Everybody should have a religion. We're not telling you which religion. And that, Scalia and Thomas firmly believe, and Alito really believe that that's okay. Gets tested. Okay, so these are the two liberals, concurring with their reason. Okay, now let's take the other side. Scalia and Thomas, they concurred also, but the Ten Commandments have an undeniable historical meaning. So they're saying, hey, Oregon, you don't have to take that Ten Commandments down.
It's Utah.
No, this was Oregon.
Oh, you had one in Utah.
Oh, no. Gosh. Okay, I'm going to have to check. I'm sorry. Okay, I think it's Oregon. Okay, the Ten. Yeah, big error. Okay.
Utah.
Utah, Oregon, what the hell?
Very different
state. That's the New Yorker's viewpoint. Right there. We got you now, business.
You know, it's Oregon. I know it's Oregon. But Utah is where the Mojave crossing. The Ten Commandments have, so this is what they wrote. The Ten Commandments have an undeniable historical meaning. Municipalities which exhibit the Ten Commandments are not complicit in the establishment of religion.
Ooh.
Okay? So they are saying that this is a historical document, and the way we voted in the Kentucky and Texas cases is still okay.
But only two of them.
Two of them.
And so seven of them didn't agree with at least that point of their concurrence. They had other points that they didn't agree, and so you can't.
what they said.
They're saying, yeah. So don't attack the Ten Commandments.
That's right.
But
they're saying something very different than what. Stevens and Ginsburg.
But they're talking about the Ten Commandments, but we're talking about the seven of Hasulitz.
I know. Well, they're seeing the seven aphorisms aren't going up, right? But they want to protect in the future other parts putting in the Ten Commandments if somebody wants to do so.
Right.
They're staking out that territory. Okay. Right. Here's our hero who flips sides. He's on the hot spot. The government speech doctrine is a rule of thumb, not a rigid category. You see, he always wants will room.
California, right?
That's where, yeah, got that in California. One must ask whether a government action burdens disproportionately in light of the action's tendency to further a legitimate government objective.
Very good with a lot of words.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's freedom of expression is not proportionately restricted.
I don't know what he means.
There it is.
You?
And you can read it as well as I.
They could show up in the park and hold up a sign, right, with the aphorisms on it?
You know.
So they just can't.
According to
there's a government speech doctrine.
There's
a rule of thumb, not a rigid category. He said the same thing. You know, he said the same thing with the gun control law. When Scalia wrote the decision in Heller, the statute in Washington, D.C. restricting guns in homes was unconstitutional because of the Second Amendment. Breyer was very careful in his dissent to rule that this doesn't cover all guns. This doesn't give you the right to have a cannon in your house or a machine gun in your house. And, you know, he is really looking at the effect these statutes have and looking at wiggle room. And he's eloquent at doing this, but he's looking at the real effect that it has on society. Okay, so
the court has a lot of tests, in addition to the rational tests, that use this proportionate, not proportionate language.
Exactly.
It's very, very common. For him, it sounds like normal speech.
Yeah,
so
Breyer uses this all the time. All the time.
And that gives him wiggle room.
And that's his wiggle room. But someone's freedom of expression is not proportionately restricted. Someone can go out there and talk all the way, but we are not restricting their freedom of expression. It's just the city doesn't have to accept their mind. They can walk through the parks, they can hand out pamphlets, they can get on a soapbox, they can do everything that everybody else does. But the city is not obligated to
accept that as government speech.
I'm sorry?
To accept that as government speech.
They can do everything else. I mean, the last sentence is, you know, the government's not usurping their freedom of expression.
No, it hinges on the definition of what a monument is.
And that's what they decide. The court, 9 unanimous. Souter, wary of establishment clause infringement, as were the two liberals, we should ask whether a reasonable and fully informed observer would understand the expression of the government speech as distinct from scribe speech the government chooses to oblige. And so, essentially, he's saying, what would a reasonable person believe? And a reasonable person walking through a park interprets what they see as supportive of the government. The government put it in there.
Even when it states that it was donated?
Yeah. Most monuments are donated by somebody.
But did the Ten Commandments say donated by the Knights of Columbus?
Yeah. And most monuments are. Look at it now more carefully. See, but once they give it, the government can do what they want. And the government can say anything they want, except religion. So you know, when you go down south, below the base of Dixon Line, and you go into these cities, and you see these statues of the Confederate soldiers, which direction are they facing? No?
North?
No. In every city, the central square, the soldier is facing south. The government in that city or that state is free to express any message they want. If you elect a different government in Raleigh, North Carolina, or Biloxi, Mississippi, and the new government wants to turn the statue around and face north, they're free to do that. Okay?
And you studied, like, on the Second Amendment issue, which is one of the things that people are any kind of suggestion about it, that would step over.
That would be over the line.
Yeah. As long as it's just
right.
a fact of
right.
its existence as
right.
a historical line.
And that comes to Senator Day O'Connor's really big concern about, is there coercion? Her bottom line is, was there coercion? So with regard to Christmas time displays, crutches, and Christmas trees, and, you know, in public squares, in public property, Christmas trees, she announced the reindeer rule. And her reindeer rule is, you know, how do you decide whether you're going to allow the government to put up a Christmas display? And she's announced the new reindeer rule. And the reindeer rule is there enough stuff put up by the government that everybody can be a little happy? So you put a wishing well, and you put a reindeer, and you put a menorah, and you put a crucifix, and you put something Islamic, and then it's okay. She was absolutely unwilling to say no religion at Christmas time on government property. She said, you could put stuff up, but it's got to pass the reindeer rule.
You said it most happy too.
Yeah. In New Hampshire, during the Vietnam, this is just sort of interesting. In New Hampshire, at the time of the Vietnam War, there was a guy named Loeb, who was editor of the Manchester Guardian, Manchester, not Manchester, New Hampshire. And he was a real right-wing zealot who felt the need to support the troops in Vietnam, they could do no wrong, and so forth. And so he remembered this saying from the battle during the Revolutionary War in Burlington, Vermont, live free or die. And he announced that he sought to, that his friend legislators in Concord, New Hampshire, have embossed on every New Hampshire license plate, live free or die. And that was in the 70s. Okay, so there it is, live free or die. a guy by the name of Maynard, or I guess Woolley, Maynard was the police officer. Woolley was a guy who kind of lived in New Hampshire, which is next to Hanover, and he didn't like it. And so he took a piece of tape and covered it up like that. And the policeman came up and arrested him. And went to the Superior Court in New Hampshire under arrest. And the judge fined him $25 and said, don't do that. And so Maynard went out and did it again. And this happened three times. Each time he was fined $25. And so he found a good lawyer, and this case worked itself up to the Supreme Court, Woolley versus Payne, 1976. And the decision by the court was one that has resonated ever since. With the decision, finding the conclusion that the government, while it can express any message it wants, may not force a citizen to carry its message. So, may not require George Hammond to walk down Parker Street here with a sandwich board saying vote for Obama. If you want to do that, you can, but the government can't force you to do that. But here, the government is forcing everybody in the state to drive around the front and back license plate with a political message. It doesn't say the land of 10,000 lakes. It doesn't say go fishing. It doesn't say the land of sky blue waters. It doesn't say the sunshine state. This is a political statement. And while the government is free to express any political message they want, it's not religious, they can't force you to carry it. Okay? So they said, no, no, New Hampshire can't do that. Now, today, you go get a license plate in New Hampshire, and ever since 1976, it's the same goddamn license plate. Live free or die.
Taken the man of the mountain off?
No, well, no, this fell off. The wrong
thing off.
But the license plate is still there. Oh, yeah, you know, some things never die. And what's the deal? The deal is that presumably New Hampshire said, well, okay, if you put tape over as I do, this is my license plate, they can't arrest you. Well, I have a copy of Woolley versus Maynard in my glove compartment, and I am waiting to be arrested. I drive around like this, I just can't.
you know, okay, and you see this, the Supreme Court does not have a police force. They have other things to concern themselves with. They handed down the decision 76 and the hand said, big deal.
Yeah.
Let's just ignore it. But we won't arrest people. Now, what I don't know, and I think we should find out, is whether there's been any instruction to police officers in New Hampshire telling them, because I don't know, these young boys, 38 years old, who are police officers, I don't know whether they know anything about this. It would be an interesting story.
They can't put on their Republican's rule or something like that, can they? That's a political
question. They can't put any political question, but they are. And so what New Hampshire's saying, so we'll let them cover it up. And so, as a result, I'm the only person in the whole state I know who comes it up. So we're back to where it was before. But it has become constitutional doctrine.
Right.
In a much larger sense, the government cannot force a person to carry a message.
But you're saying the government can't put a message on there.
The
but
government
they could put a message
no, the government can put any message as long, any message, as long as it's not religion.
Right.
They can't do that. And they can't force you to carry it.
Right, but they could put vote Republican,
Republican
rule.
No. Oh, yes, they could.
Right.
They could.
And you just have to cover it up.
And you're free to cover it up.
And you can put your own message on it.
Well, you know, I mean, you got a right there, I suppose. I don't know. I got arrested, not arrested, I got stopped on 101 on the way to Santa Fe last year. And Faye and I were waiting to see a movie at 10 o'clock at night. And we only had about 8 minutes to get there. But I wasn't speeding, I was just going with the traffic. And this blue light, and we get pulled over as we're going towards Santa Fe. And Faye, we have this 15-year-old Jaguar, and she has this sort of chrome, license plate holder.
Right.
And the license plate holder cut right through here. Live Free or Die was very visible, but the chrome sort of cut through here. And the police officer gave us and he gave me this really hard time about don't ever do this again. I'm not going to give you a ticket, but that's, I can't know what state you're from. No, I was right. I said, no other state has lived here back to the state. And new had, how many. You can still read that answer. I mean, you know what it is, even if you don't see the bottom.
Not sure.
He was really, so after he got all finished, he took down, I said, now you have my name, my address, my driver's license, all about me, how many kids I have, what I did, where I lived. I heard, I'd like your name. And you just turned back. You just turned pale. Okay. So now, I'm going to end this by showing you this character, South Carolina. How's that? And so, when this came out by South Carolina, the neighborhood, the Islamics, various Hindus came up and said, okay, you're putting on religious license plates, I see. We want one with the Mohammed David on it, we want one with this on it, that on it, everything. And the state refused.
What year is it?
Just recently. Not South Carolina. But don't think it stopped in South Carolina. Here is Arizona. Choose life.
Wow.
So Planned Parenthood walked into the Department of Motor Vehicles and said, choice. Right? Sorry, we don't have that list. I'm not interested in producing that.
Huh.
Government speech or private speech?
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
Now, it's not religion.
Oh.
Very testy.
It's a religious concept.
Yeah, the disagreement is religious. Yes, the disagreement stems from religion. I mean, these are tough, how about an analysis of government speech, private speech? It would it be different if all these, you can go through five license plates and pick out, I can choose this one, or choose life, or everybody should have an abortion, or, all these different alternatives. What is this? So anyway, these are interesting questions, all of which the Supreme Court is not particularly interested in wading into. And here's Florida. It never stops the protection of civil liberties.
A black face. That's interesting.
Right.
So the problem goes on, and I simply will, I think, end this here by just bringing to our attention the question of whether what you see is government speech or private speech. I think it's really, I like it.
There should have been.
It's a miserable night.
There were 11 people signed up to be here, so that tells you that
the weather
was
terrible. And the traffic coming down is just, I've got to find a better way to get here.
Helicopter.
Do you live in
Well, that was great.
I live in New Hampshire. I come out here for 2 months in the winter.
Ah.
I made a whole lot of friends. You can see them all here. These are my two good fans.
You've heard of Arnold's Army?
Okay,
that was just great. Sorry that the weather got in the way, but that was great. Very good discussion. You should have been a lawyer.
No, I'm okay. So this is my little clicker, and I'm all done.
They,
and that's,
you know,
this
they
is
love
the,
to
this d- is
divide it up and decide, you know, how are we going to make these decisions? And so they've got to come up with their tests.
Right.
And then, you know, and I love the concurring opinions. That was just great because it just showed, you know, they were all in agreement on the one thing, but they all had to.
They had to get their
put
their
in. Put their yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Put their markers down for the next group of lawyers that were taking a look at what they were up to.